I'm sure my dip tongues, or whatever they call it, are going to be awful right now because I don't have my pop filter.
And then there's that.
Wash down the phlegm with some raspberry LaCroix.
Gross.
Welcome to another episode of the MacGuffin Podcast, the movie review podcast that dreams are made of. Keith Foster, San Diego.
You almost blew it.
I almost did.
Yeah.
I almost went right into the old thing. Keith Foster, you're my co-host from San Diego.
Cassidy Robinson, you're my co-host from Las Vegas.
What? Yes. So the reason there hasn't been a show, among many reasons why there hasn't been a show in the last couple weeks, is I moved. I just made the announcement to most people I know on Facebook the other day. It was a very unceremonious exit from Los Angeles. I kind of trickled that information out as it approached, and then it just happened. So
you know, there was a point in time when people didn't have to like
tell every single person.
You didn't have to update your Facebook status because Facebook didn't exist.
Right.
You updated your MySpace status.
Right. That's how it used to be. Before Facebook, there was MySpace. And then before that, we were just like, you know, drawing on the sides of bathroom stalls to let people know what we were doing.
Yeah. So, I
did that too. But... And
okay.
Susie Q's on the way to...
No, it's not that kind of podcast.
Anyway, so I moved. I was also on and off being sick, and office bug caught my throat, and the only thing it was really affecting was my speech, which was a huge, huge bummer. And I thought about even just doing a croaky episode on, you know, one of the biggest movies of the year. Oh, here it comes. It's back.
don't do this to me.
I thought about just doing a bad episode on Avengers Endgame, but I wouldn't do that to the people, and I really didn't want to have to try and edit and pack at the same time. So here we are. People. We're doing the show
to the people.
It's for the people, Keith. It's always for the people, and hopefully some of their friends. So we are talking about Avengers Endgame today, and we're also going to be catching up with the new animated Laika film, Missing Link. If anybody follows us on Instagram, I made a funny. I was packing, and every time I move, and I'm moving my DVDs, which is, you know, 90% of packing for me, I always come across that short film you made in Pocatello, The Search for Sasquatch.
Oh, yeah.
And I always forget it exists until I'm moving.
Have you even watched it?
Yeah, I watched it. When it was first sent to me by your director slash co-star, Kim Kahn. Shout out to Kim Kahn. I took it downstairs, actually, to my new roommates here in Nevada, who you also know and have been on the show. We're going to have to watch that at some point.
I'm still proud of my performance in that movie.
Do you use it for your reel?
I don't really have a reel because I'm what's considered lazy and a, air quotes, bad actor who needs to get his shit together if he wants to be taken seriously as a professional. Seriously, what are you even doing? Wasting my time? Get out of my office. Just get out.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You should definitely have a reel. And you've done enough video performance that you could put one together pretty easily.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. I actually don't want to get into it. It's
Shop talk.
It is an actual thing.
This is a portion of the podcast where I'm Keith's motivational speaker or career guidance.
You're so fucking bad at it.
I know. I don't even have a job right now. But this is my job, Keith. This is us here reviewing movies. Let's go ahead and do your little game. And tell me what this is.
Fuck you.
You proposed this a long time ago, actually.
I did. And
so what is this?
So we've done this segment once previously. It's called Dreamcast. How it works is we take a movie property or a movie that we know is going to be coming out soon, but doesn't have a cast attached to it yet, and we fill those roles with our Dreamcast. If you go back a couple years ago, we did this with the Aladdin live-action reboot.
Which is about to come out.
Yeah, yeah. And we were very off on all the actors.
I still like my cast better.
And we were a little racist. I was a little racist.
Mostly
unintentionally.
You. Yeah.
In this, for this edition of Dreamcast, we're going to be talking about a property of superheroes that Marvel just got back.
Mm-hmm.
The merger with Fox is closed. It's a done deal. Endgame is over. So Marvel's going to be looking to new properties to revive, to keep the MCU alive. So we're going to be talking about the first family of Marvel, the Fantastic Four. Now, there have been three previous Fantastic Four movies. All of them have been drivel. All of them have been just fucking garbage.
Oh, Keith.
And I think...
Keith, there's been four previous Fantastic Four. Four movies.
I'm not counting the fucking Roger Corman one.
Oh, you definitely should. It was a movie that was made and
nobody's
completed.
Seen it.
You can if you
yeah,
go.
But nobody's
go to your local Comic-Con right now, and somebody will sell it to you.
Yeah, but that's like a black market. Like that's a whole different transaction of movie. Like, are we really counting the fucking made-for-TV Spider-Man shit from the 70s? Are we counting? The Hulk meets Daredevil from the fucking 80s or whatever. No, that doesn't count.
It happened, and some people I've heard prefer it to the three theatrical ones.
They're fucking contrarian. Oh, the Fantastic Four.
Right.
Sure, whatever. So for some reason, this has been a really hard property for movie studios to get right, for them to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big part of that is they haven't had the right cast. They've cast people with like zero chemistry. I mean, you can make a case for Chris Evans as Human Torch and Michael Chiklis as the Thing, but it ends there.
Yeah.
So we're specifically, for the sake of this, we're going to be casting for the characters Mr. Fantastic, Sue Storm, the Invisible Woman, Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, Ben Grimm, the Thing, and because he was introduced sort of in the Fantastic Four and he's a big part of their world, we're also going to be talking about Namor, the Submariner, assuming they don't do a solo venture with him, which I think would draw too many comparisons to Aquaman.
Probably.
So. I think it'd be smarter for them to introduce him in Fantastic Four, but that's just editorializing. And of course, their main villain and one of the heavy hitters of the MCU, Doctor Doom.
Mm-hmm. All right, Keith, how do you want to do this? Back and forth?
I'll start with you for Mr. Fantastic then, because my Mr. Fantastic and my Sue Storm are linked.
There's a couple different ways you can approach Mr. Fantastic. As we've seen him most of the time in the comic, he's a little bit older. He has, like, the graying temples. He's, you know, a scientist. You're supposed to believe that he's a smart person. He's also sort of an everyman to some degree, right? He's the leader of the team. Mm-hmm. And then there's, like, the younger version, which Ultimate Fantastic Four sort of did. And I think when they did the Fantastic Four, most recently the Josh Trank version, that was kind of what they were tapping into with their cast, which skewed a little younger.
I saw that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is so fucking bad. like I saw it sort of passively on TV in a hotel room, And it, so I didn't see like the whole thing through and through, but I saw like the last hour.
It didn't get better.
No, it's boring.
I actually heard the last half is the worst half. I never saw the movie, but I, you know, usually the critique was first half was fine and then it goes off the rails.
No, the whole thing is off the rails. Man, that thing was stillborn. Anyway.
I want to go with an actor. I'm going a younger cast for the most part. Not everybody here, but for the most part. Okay. And for my Mr. Fantastic, I am going to cast, most recently in the Star Wars Solo movie, Alden Ehrenreich.
Oh, interesting.
I think he's a good actor, which matters. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He has layers. He has depth. I think you can believe him being very, very intelligent. You can also believe him being kind of silly and stupid. I think that, he has a range that I don't think we've seen out of him in Mr. Fantastic yet. And it's not an inherently interesting character, unless you know how to write him. So an actor is going to have to bring a lot to it. And I think he's a strong, young-ish actor.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So I'll tell you both my Mr. Fantastic and my Sue Storm, because they're...
Oh, you're doing him as a couple.
Yeah. They're,
all right. So
that's one of the things that I think the previous movies have gotten wrong about the movie incarnation so far. Is Fantastic Four, yes, they are a super team, but they're not a super team like the Avengers or like the X-Men or the Justice League, because they are a family.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that family unit has been missing from all the previous incarnations. So for that reason, I'm actually specifically, I don't want a younger cast for my Mr. Fantastic. I don't want too old because, you know, we have to think of franchisability.
Right.
But I want someone who's a little older. So that I, in my mind, they're already married. They're already family. We're just getting that out of the way. And who better to do that than real life couple, John Krasinski and Emily Blunt?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So one of the things about, you talked, I feel like all of those things you mentioned with Alden Ehrenreich.
Yes.
Are the same for John Krasinski. He's just aged a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely checks that everyman box.
Yeah.
I think he can play very intelligent. I think he can be a little aloof too, which is important for Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Plus he has real life chemistry with his real life wife, Emily Blunt, who is, she's not super young, but she's still very attractive, very Hollywood, but she can play a mom, I think. And that's really important to who Sue Storm is. So, also, I read in an interview once, like many years ago, like a year ago or something, that John Krasinski would be like totally down for that. And I just haven't been able to get it out of my head. I'm going to be disappointed if Marvel doesn't cast those two as in those roles.
All right. Yeah, that definitely skews everything a lot older, but that's not necessarily a problem.
Who's your Invisible Woman?
My Invisible Woman, Sue Storm. I wanted somebody who shows a lot of vulnerability, somebody who also has depth as an actor, but can bring it. You know, not somebody who's just going to sit there mousy and quiet and the screen does nothing. I need someone who has interiority, but also strength. And I am giving the role to Elle Fanning.
What do I know her from? I know the name, because she's Dakota's little sister, right?
Right. She's done a lot of indie stuff. Most recently, she was in Nicholas Winding Refn's Neon Demon. Probably not the most recently, but she was in that. She was also in Somewhere, the Sofia Coppola movie. She's been around. She was in Super 8, quite a while ago.
Okay. I'm pulling up some pictures of her. I actually don't know if I've ever seen her in a movie.
You've seen Super 8.
Well, yeah, but she was really young in that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she's got the right look. She's a little younger than I would personally want, but I can see it.
She's probably like 22 or 3 now, but
sure, yeah.
And if you catch up with her more recent stuff, I think she's showing a lot of like edge and like doing some really interesting stuff now.
I can see it. I can see it. I'm not mad at this.
You want to go ahead with Johnny Storm?
Yeah, yeah. So,
this is the sort of the character that makes or breaks it, right? Because this is the one that like all the kids are going to want to buy the toy after.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've got this one down. I'm actually really happy with my Johnny Storm, and also I think that in the past movie incarnations, mm-hmm. they've gotten him the most correct. Like I thought Michael B. Jordan did a good job as mm-hmm. Johnny Storm. I thought Chris Evans did a good job. Like, unfortunately, their scripts were garbage.
Right.
And, like, the rest of the movie kind of couldn't keep up with them. But he seems to be sort of the easiest character for the movies to nail down. And I think it's because he's fun. He's, you know, he's a cocky fly boy.
Right.
He's usually the comedic relief. So you need somebody really charming who can do that. I think a little bit younger than Sue Storm. She's the older sister.
Mm-hmm.
So my cast is Taron Egerton.
I like that.
Yeah, from Kingsman, and going to be playing Elton John in the upcoming Rocketman movie.
Right, right.
And he's got that really classic Johnny Storm look.
Sure.
And he can pull off the charm and the swagger, so.
Yeah. No, yeah, I have no problem with that. Mine is very kind of similar. I mean, he's not English, but they're kind of like come from the same graduating class. Recently had a big hit with Edgar Wright, Ansel Elgort.
Okay. I actually considered him. Yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think he's never played outright cocky before, but he mm-hmm. definitely has a confidence to him, and I think he could lean into that pretty easily. I think he can handle comedic material if possible, or if necessary. And again, you know, good looking kid, central casting kind of face, but I think that he can show depth when he needs to.
My only criticism really is and this might be really weird because I know you can play with angles and stuff. He seems so much physically bigger than who you've cast for Sue Storm. So that to me, that seems a little weird. Like, I don't know that quite matches up. And when I was thinking Emily Blunt, I was literally thinking like Taron Egerton looks like he could be her little brother.
Yeah.
Because, again, I just that family dynamic is what I'm going for. So,
it's not all that uncommon, though, that a sister will have a taller older brother.
No, it's not. I mean, you could make it work on film, you
right.
know, through costuming and everything. It just, when you mention them, that kind of stands out to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to give me your Ben Grimm?
This one was the hardest for me. And I think what I realized is, you know, in the last X amount of years, if I'm trying to find somebody who's sort of age appropriate for the rest of my cast, in the last, you know, let's say 20 years or so, we haven't really, like, been fostering new heavies. You know, like,
yeah.
who, mm-hmm. like, who totally. Are the actors out there who, like, are going to speak with a thick Brooklyn accent with a cigar hanging out of their mouth? There's like no actor who fits that type anymore.
Especially younger actors.
Right.
That's totally true because it's so like the movies are being sort of built on the MCU formula already
mm-hmm.
that it's hard, I think, for young character actors to find those types of roles.
Right. Yeah. And then if you do get kind of a somebody who has a different build, they're usually kind of playing a little bit more into, I guess, like a Chris Farley type or something. Anyway, so I really just tried to go with somebody who has a deep voice because they're going to be covered in rocks. It doesn't matter what they look like so much. And I thought this might be kind of funny given, you know, his, like, status as a sex symbol. Liam Hemsworth.
Okay.
He's tall, very tall, and he has a very deep voice.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, and if we've learned anything about the Hemsworths, it's that they can, they have more comedic chops than you'd expect from somebody so handsome.
Yeah, he was particularly funny in that, one movie we did with Rebel Wilson. I forgot what
it was called. Isn't it romantic?
Isn't it romantic? Mm-hmm. I thought he was good in that. And I think it would be kind of like one of the things about Ben Grimm as a character is he has all this sort of neurosis about the way he looks and like trying to present as human and like holding on to his humanity. And if you used to look like Liam Hemsworth, that becomes a lot more believable.
Yeah, yeah. I think they kind of... We're going with a similar approach in the Josh Trank one with when they cast Jamie Bell,
right?
As the thing, I think Liam Hemsworth sounds like he would be better, and I'm just I don't know.
I'm not in love with this pick, but I landed on it.
Yeah, I had kind of a harder time with this one too, even though I'm going with you know, slightly older actors. I also don't want to cast too old.
Right.
And there aren't a lot of character heavies. So who I thought of, and I think would fit in really well with the cast I've established, is none other than the most recent screen version of Hellboy, David Harbour.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
He can be really funny and entertaining. And I think it would be good for him as a role to not have the whole weight of the picture on him, but I think he's one of those guys who could sort of stand out as like a fan favorite.
Right, and support.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Here it gets a little bit more interesting. We're talking about our villains.
Yeah.
Side characters.
Do you want to go Doom first or Namor?
Let's do Doom
Namor
first.
Namor's sort of the wild card.
Yeah.
Namor's sort of a wild card.
Namor's the sort of the unknown quantity in this conversation. So let's go ahead and do Doom first. I'm going to pick for my Doom a European actor to kind of give off that natural evil. Alexander Skarsgård.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can see it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's a solid pick. I flirted with that idea myself, actually.
Mm-hmm. I just saw him in something recently, and I think he could pull it off.
Yeah, my thing with Alexander Skarsgård is I've never seen him in anything that I've been particularly excited by him.
Right.
I'm not saying he's a bad actor. I don't know if he's sort of had that sort of role he needs yet.
Yeah, he's never... Well, I don't want to say he's never been in something juicy, because I might have just not seen something that where he was the, you know, the thing that brought everyone in.
He was pretty popular in True Blood.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. But I think, you know, he's also another vain character, the Dr. Mm-hmm. Doom. And, you know, he wears, like, the metal faceplate because his face is all burned up and that kind of thing. And I think, like, against the cast that I've already set up, I think he's the one that can be a little bit older.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I kind of went the same way with mine, too, is...
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking Dr. Doom might be... He might be kind of a one-shot villain.
Yeah.
Sort of like the Red Skull in Captain America First Avenger using Hugo Weaving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Marvel's sort of notorious for casting really good actors for villains and not giving them a lot to chew on.
Right.
I would hope that they would go the other way with this. So I wanted like a big name for my Doctor Doom. John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, like, you know, they sold A Quiet Place off of their star power.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you'd have a fun conversation with that. But I wanted someone who could sort of, like, stand up to that star power. And yeah. I was kind of torn between a few people, actually. But I'll go with my gut. The first one that sort of stood out to me is like, oh, yeah, he could be scary as fuck. Viggo Mortensen.
Okay. I mean, yeah, he's, you know, very capable. He's pretty up there in age.
He is.
But
he is.
Your cast is already a generation or so older than mine, so.
For sure, yeah. So I could go a little bit older, you know, because he's, what, 60? He just
something like 60? That? Yeah.
And, I mean, for a lot of the movie, he's either going to be in makeup or armor.
Right.
And I just, I think he is the type of actor that could... He doesn't do a lot of really commercial movies like this. So I think if he was to do a movie like that, he would have to have something good to work with. And I think he could make a lot out of a little if it came to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's the guy I kept going back to. And... it was actually between him and another person who I'm just going to tell you for fun. I was also thinking maybe Hugh Jackman, because it might be fun for him to sort of play the other side of the superhero coin.
Yeah, I could see that.
But
I think that might confuse people, but...
Yeah, and I just think, kind of like you said with Skarsgård, you know, Viggo has that... Eastern European thing going for him.
Right.
That I think could make him a little bit more believable than Hugh, but...
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so Namor. Now, a lot of people don't know who Namor the Sea Mariner is.
So apparently even you, because he is Namor the Submariner.
The Submariner. Sorry. Do you want to describe this character?
So he's definitely a parallel to Aquaman in a lot of ways. He's the king of Atlantis. He's widely regarded. He was the first mutant character that Marvel Comics like labeled as a mutant. So he lives under the ocean. He's mostly known for running around in a green Speedo, and being egotistical as fuck. Like,
yeah, I think that's the big difference between him and Aquaman is sort of the mood and tone of the character. He's like, kind of outwardly a dick.
Well, and he's sort of, he's had some heel turns. Like, he's been, you know, borderline a villain in the past.
Mm-hmm.
He's not, and that's why I think he would be good in a Fantastic Four movie versus his own movie, because you could really play with that expectation of like, is he a villain or is he like helping?
Right.
Because yeah, he can be, he's such a narcissist, but in the funnest way. Like if you get a good writer with the Submariner,
he could steal the show. Yeah,
absolutely. So he's kind of a hard one to cast too, because he's got to be really attractive. I mean, there's sort of a through line in the comics where he is very flirtatious and tries to seduce the Invisible Woman. And that I feel like that dynamic should be a believable threat. That's why I think, again, it'd be more fun if they're a little bit older, and that you can have maybe someone a little younger and a little more attractive really sort of threaten Mr. Fantastic's masculinity. Could be a lot of fun. So this is, it's a hard part to cast. I wanted to go with a relative of unknown for mine. I don't know. He's not unknown, but he hasn't had a lot of exposure here in the States. I am casting the lead, the romantic lead from Crazy Rich Asians, Henry Golding.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think he's he was really good in Crazy Rich Asians. He was really good in A Simple Favor. But he's sort of, I could see him getting sort of boxed into this type of like attractive romantic ingenue.
Right.
Sort of going down the Matthew McConaughey road a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think it'd be fun to see him like give him a character like this where he could really vamp it up. Because I just feel like he's got it in him. Plus, he's got the abs for it.
Uh-huh.
And I think he could have that sort of mysterious, seductive quality that we need from a Namor.
Totally. I'm into that casting. So this, it's kind of funny, because as I was doing my casting, I had this actor first as Mr. Fantastic, then I moved him down to Johnny Storm, then I moved him finally to Namor. And I think he fits here best. But again, I think going European, kind of making him a little bit different than the rest of the cast. And I think that he has kind of a wider range. And I think he can do all the things that we've been talking about already. Ben Whishaw.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that. I definitely like Ben Whishaw as an actor, but personally, I see him more as a Mr. Fantastic, because I don't know if he has that sex appeal. I don't know.
I think he does for a lot of people.
He seems a little wispy to me.
I think that's how he's been in previous movies, but I think he could make this turn.
That's true. He could pull a real Loki and, you know, be that pasty British boy that the fangirls love for the next generation.
Right. I mean, there's already like internet fandom like sex appeal for Ben Whishaw. That exists already. So it's just about tapping into that. And then I believe he was in, what was that Wachowski thing, that really weird one, like the multiple stories?
Not Jupiter Ascending.
No, the one before that. Atlas Shrugs? No, that's not what it's called.
What is it? What is that fucking movie? I know what you're talking about. Atlas Neverland?
Cloud Atlas.
Okay.
I believe he played a part in that was a little bit more flamboyant and kind of fun and had more to do in that than we see him like in, say, the playing the new Q in the Bond movies or whatever, or doing the voice of a cartoon bear.
My only thing is, does he look good without a shirt on? Because Namor has to look good without a shirt on. And that's, I mean, that is something you can build up.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, something that you can cheat a little bit if needed. I'm not saying no. But he's one of those that I would have to sort of see it.
Right.
But that could be very interesting.
I think it would work. I think people would be into it.
It's definitely a different take. Mm-hmm. Not as progressive as mine, where I want to specifically cast an Asian as the sex symbol of the movie.
But that's I'm specifically casting a out gay actor in the role, and we could have him hitting on Mr. Fantastic instead of Sue Storm. Yes.
I would not be mad at that at all. Or if he's just sort of, he could be pansexual even and just be hitting on everybody. I would love that. Yeah. All right. So that is our dream cast. Please, write us, tweet us, tell us, which cast you like more. Tell us which movie you would be seeing, or you'd be more excited about. And also, you know, if you feel like we left anybody out or feel like, you know, there's an obvious cast member that we're missing, just let us know.
All right, let's go ahead and get into our reviews. With Avengers Endgame came out a couple of weeks ago. It's been dominating the box office ever since. It's about to surpass James Cameron's for Avatar. And, yeah, I mean, you know, we reviewed the first half of this saga last year. Do you want to... What's going on in Avengers Endgame? Do you want to catch everybody up?
Yeah. I mean, if you're listening to this, I'm sure you've probably seen it by now. But at the end of Infinity War, Thanos snapped half of the universe out of existence.
Yes, he collects all of the Infinity Stones. The worst happens.
It ends on a massive cliffhanger, kind of a bummer. As an audience, we're left thinking, you know, like, we know some of these characters are coming back, but we don't know how. So this movie is that. It picks up... the movie starts pretty close to right after the events of Infinity War. The characters are licking their wounds.
Trying to figure out who lived, who died.
Yeah, and what they can do to stop this. These are characters that are not used to losing, and they don't do it well. So, you know, immediately they try to bounce back and think, what can we do to prevent this or to possibly reverse it? What's our next move? I feel like if you haven't seen it, it is going to be hard to review this movie without giving some spoilers. So, forewarned, I mean, there's so many spoilers out there now that, again, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it and it hasn't been spoiled for you, stop listening and go watch it. Because I don't know how you managed. Let's just fuck it and say spoilers. This is our spoiler-filled review for Avengers Endgame.
Sure. Okay, I think we can get into some of the finer details of the plot. You know, the biggest like overarching mission that our team is on now, the surviving members of the Avengers, they have to figure out a way to sort of turn back time and get everybody back. You know, be able to transport themselves to a time or to a situation where they could find the Infinity Stones before Grimace, whatever his name is.
Thanos.
And
Thanos set it up in a way that what he did could not be undone without literally traveling into the past, without time travel to collect a new set of Infinity Stones.
Right. And if you've seen the most recent Ant-Man and Wasp, you'll know that our hero, Ant-Man, was trapped forever in a particle universe, a sub-molecular universe, where after, you know, he was sent into that area, the other teammates got snapped out of existence where he was stuck there. When he comes back 5 years later, he realizes no time has passed for him, you know, something to do with relativity or science-y something or other. And they figure out a way to sort of mechanize that. Tony Stark specifically figures out a way to mechanize that, and they build a time machine and come up with missions to split the team up into sort of different factions. And it's kind of fun because, in a way, this movie is sort of like a little bit of a greatest hits, because we get to go back and see all these little situations that we've seen in previous Marvel movies from another perspective, sort of Back to the Future 2 style.
They have to go back to times when they have encountered the Infinity Stones before, so they know that their exact location, because specifically the way this movie plays with time travel is they cannot alter the events of the past. That sort of creates... So they can't directly influence the events of Infinity War. All of that happened. All they can hope to do is gather these Infinity Stones so that they have a chance to set it right.
Yeah, create a new future.
Yes. And that is one of my favorite things about this movie, is that they managed to set it up in a way, like, once they introduced time shenanigans, mm-hmm. I'm starting to go, okay, well, they're just going to go back in time and undo everything.
Right.
But I like the way they set it up, because they set it up in a way that everything of the previous movie mattered. Everything right. that happened. And that was one of my biggest fears going into this, is that it was just going to be sort of, you know, magically everything's fixed
right.
or whatever. But no, the stakes were real. The characters that died in Infinity War. And this is just damage control. This is just trying to put the world back. All they can hope to do is save the people who were snapped out of existence. But
right.
Everybody else, you know, everybody's dead. They're actually gone. And I really liked that. The movie plays with stakes in a way that no other MCU movie has done.
Yeah, I mean, there is some kind of comic booky, let's figure out a way to bring people back from the dead going on. That is what the movie is.
Yes, but it's done in a way to where the ramifications of the event are still felt. It's not just retconned.
Right, right. Yeah. And there was definitely opportunity for them to do that if they wanted to, especially going back into these previous situations that we've seen in the other movies. What I liked about this, less to do with, you know, the overall impact of the tragedy of the snap from the first movie, and more to do with just the mechanics of how to deal with a plot where you have a gazillion characters. Mm-hmm. Because
yeah.
that's a problem with a lot of team-up movies and a lot of, like, large ensembles like this. You know, go back to any X-Men movie. Is that you have one or two characters who are kind of really the stars, and then you have a bunch of people who are sort of standing in the background. And you get to see them in the fight scenes for a couple scenes. The best way to deal with this, and I think that both Infinity War and this movie dealt with it really well, is break up the action and, mm-hmm. you know, send little factions of the team into different scenarios, and now these characters can sort of be the leads of their scenario. And yeah, everybody yeah, and gets a good amount of play, everybody gets stakes into the plot, and mm-hmm. everybody has, you know, some sort of effect on what's going on. It makes it much much more fun to watch as an ensemble piece.
Yeah, rather than just a couple people dictating all the action. That being said, this is still primarily Captain America and Iron Man's movie.
Like, yeah, I mean, I would say they're the principal leads.
Yeah, and I really like that this movie. It has a very satisfying conclusion to these, you know, fucking 8 movie arcs that each character has had. Mm-hmm. Same with Thor. Thor 2.
Yeah.
I think the way the movie is sort of broken up is really smart and really satisfying. I like the first chunk of the movie that is, it's a lot quieter than anything we got in Infinity War. It's a lot of just setting a mood.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't really an action set piece for, I mean, for really the first half of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, we get a little bit of kind of tying up loose ends in the front. That involves a little bit of action. But then it's kind of more just solemn and them sort of like dealing with things and reconciling and whatever. And that's all works fine. I'm glad that isn't where we stay. I will say that once Ant-Man enters a picture, it's like a breath of fresh air.
Totally.
That we definitely need by that point. And again, kind of going back to what I was saying, this is the first movie where I felt like Ant-Man has been a significant character in a movie. Like, even more so than his movies, where he's always just this guy along for the ride. He's kind of that here too, but he has a sort of significance in this whole time heist that they come up with.
I agree. It's sort of the most valued he's been as a team member.
Yeah.
And had sort of it's the most he's felt like an actual part of the team versus that funny guy who happens to have powers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, like, we said this with Infinity War, too. Like, there's no reason on paper this movie should work. It should have been a fucking mess. And I have really minor trifles with it. But for the most part, I was engaged throughout the whole thing. I cared about some characters that I didn't really give a shit about in prior movies. You mentioned Ant-Man. I'm going to say Black Widow. She's been just sort of a background badass chick in most of the movies she's in. This is the first one where we see her actually have, like, character development.
Yeah. Hawkeye, too.
Hawkeye too. Yeah,
he plays definitely. You know, if we're talking about comic books and stuff, because once upon a time that this all used to be in comic books. But I want to see like a 12 issue arc of the time that Hawkeye was just a crazy badass assassin going around the country killing Yakuza.
Yeah,
I just want that comic book.
His story is real dark.
Yeah.
to the point where you can kind of almost feel the Disney executives getting a little uncomfortable. They're like, okay, but how many people is he going to kill on screen?
Right.
I agree. It was, and it, again, it was something that his character needed to keep him vital. And to make him feel like he should even be in the movie. He's not just the guy with arrows anymore.
Yeah.
He's now actually has, like, a personal connection to what's going on.
Right, and I always thought that Jeremy Renner was a good choice for that part, but then it's like the first Avengers movie, he's possessed half the movie, and then the other ones, he's kind of more comedic relief, where he's just barely there or not there at all. This is the first time where I was like, okay, yeah, if you're going to have Jeremy Renner, an Oscar-nominated actor, doing this, give him something to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's these time shenanigans, and then that inevitably leads us to the giant action set piece at the end of the movie, which is as big as it gets.
Big war.
I mean,
fight, fight, fight.
And I would be lying if I said it wasn't cool as fuck. But it's also still really dynamic. It's not a boring fight. Like, we know what, again, I think this movie sort of relies on how much you buy into the stakes, how much you feel the 22 movie or the 21 movies that have led up to this.
Right.
Yeah,
I could have used less of that. I really like the first half of the movie when they're jumping around. They have these little mini missions, and you kind of get to laser focus on specific characters and specific events, and they have to use their wits a lot more than just their brawn, because it's a lot about avoiding certain people, not changing history, blah blah blah. All of that I thought was really fun and really interesting. Yeah, and you know, the first third of the movie is necessary to connect to the previous film and kind of catch us up. So all of that's cool. I felt like the movie sort of forces us into a big giant Battle of Helm's Deep kind of style, like army of superheroes against army of supervillains, and then you bring in the Chitauri, and then you bring in, you know, giant lasers and bombs, and it gets a little World of Warcrafty for me towards the end, and I kind of lose interest because I know it's just like a big battle, and I'm just waiting for it to get over so I can see who lived and who died, or what the, you know, get to the ultimate thing, which is killing Thanos. To me that felt very similar to sort of the Kevin Feige disaster quota that we always have to end on in one of these Marvel movies. And I would have liked a little less of that. I would have liked it to kind of conclude in a more personal way rather than just, you know, a battle of every single Marvel character that's been on screen thus far.
I'm going to have to agree to disagree with you on that one. this is the payoff. This is what we didn't get in Infinity War. Like, this, I, as a fan, needed this.
You want to see every single character that's been on screen thus far fighting every other character that's been on screen thus far. Because to me, this felt like action figures
That's exactly what I want to see. That is exactly what I need to see. I need to see Captain America being the most badass we've seen Captain America.
Uh-huh.
I need to see Iron Man at his Iron Manist. I needed it. I wanted it. I was here for it.
Okay.
I mean, this movie's 3 fucking hours long. I didn't feel a minute of it. I was on the edge of my seat. They somehow managed to translate these giant splash pages of what would be a splash page in a comic book into a movie frame in a way that I've never seen before. The battle is so incredibly epic. I feel like you needed that payoff after this many movies of build up to this ultimate badass of Thanos. Like,
to me, it was a little too calculatedly epic. Like, I would have liked it to defy my expectations a little bit more. And I mean, and there's pockets of stuff interesting happening in that battle when it gets to our principal characters. But, you know, I'm just not the type of guy that wants to see a giant war on screen. Like, that doesn't really do much for me.
You know, there's an entire genre of movies dedicated to that exact thing.
No, I know. And I think that in some cases, like, that can be appropriate. But, like, I'm not the type of, like, fan that wants to see, like, gigantic, you know, hundreds of characters fighting each other in you know, utter chaos.
I will say I'm not typically like that's because usually, you know, in the buildup of one movie, I feel like it feels a lot more predictable to me. Mm-hmm. It feels like, okay, here's our standard battle. And you know, typically in the comic books it feels that way too. It's like, okay, you know, we're building to this giant fan service off.
Right.
But again, for the sake of the MCU, for the sake of this movie, I felt like I needed it because I felt like I didn't really get it in the first in Infinity War. And that was something that kind of disappointed me, was that we never saw all the characters come together in the way that was promised. And that was something that just sort of sat weird with me in Infinity War. And now after seeing Endgame, I realize that these aren't two movies. This is just one movie with a year-long intermission.
Right.
And so because of that, I needed it. I was so excited to see all these characters fighting side by side in ways that I never thought I would see on screen. I somehow managed to have these nerdgasm moments, which I didn't know I was still capable of. I mean, the last few Marvel movies I've seen, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, that was cool. But I haven't gone, like, I haven't shit my brains out with awesomeness.
Right.
In the way this movie delivered for me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, overall, I like the movie quite a bit. And I think that it totally fulfills, you know, the promise of Infinity War last year. I think it's a good companion piece. I think it wraps up, you know, what we've seen in the MCU so far. Like, this build up to the whole Thanos threat is totally paid off.
Yes.
And I think that this, you know, if you've been following it thus far, there's no reason you'll be disappointed with it. I did like it. I just thought the final battle sequence was a little predictable and not, like, terribly interesting compared to what came before it.
And I'm just calling you a grump.
I give the movie a solid B+. I give the Infinity War Endgame experience, if you look at it as one thing, probably like an A-.
I give it an A-. There are when I came out of the theater, I was just like, holy fuck, what did I see? Oh my god, you know. I can't believe they pulled it. Just everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't not talk about it in public, which I felt bad about. And I tried to be respectful of people who might not have seen it. So, but I just couldn't stop gushing. And then I thought about certain things a little bit. And there were little pet peeves and little things that I was like, well, okay, I think that could have been handled a little more gracefully, or, you know, certain things could have been smoothed out, or I think, you know, maybe if certain things had played out a different way, it might have been just even more satisfying. But I give it an A-. I can't believe I can't believe what Marvel has achieved here with this. Having it even be entertaining is one thing, but having it be good is entirely different. So I just, like, kudos to the Marvel Studios, everyone involved. Like, there's never been a movie like this. If you think about it, like, this has never been achieved. They essentially told a season of television, but with each episode being its own movie.
In 10 years.
Over the past decade. Like, it's just incredible what they pulled off. So most of my criticisms, most of my gripes are minor at best. You know, they still exist, but just they stuck the landing. They really pulled it off. I give it, I give it an A-.
Yeah. All right, cool. So instead of doing Netflix homework, we have another movie we're going to review that we had on the back burners. This is Missing Link, which has come out in theaters kind of recently. And it was kind of a little animated film I wanted to see because I like to follow what's going on over in the Portland animation house, Laika Studios. The animation house that brought us Coraline and Paranorman, Box Trolls, and Kubo and the Two Strings. And this is written and directed by Chris Butler, who had previously brought us Paranorman, which is one of my favorite of the bunch. And it is a sort of a little bit of a stylistic departure from what we've known from Laika thus far, although I think Kubo is already sort of pulling us out of that sort of Henry Selick post-Tim Burton style quite a bit. But here, we have sort of a 20th century, early 20th
like
century.
Like turn of the century,
Turn of the century explorer named Sir Lionel Frost, voiced by Hugh Jackman, who is looking for different kind of paranormal and cryptozoological phenomena around the world. We see him at the beginning of the movie sort of trying to capture evidence of Nessie, and we know that he's sort of going around the world looking for these types of things. And we also find out that he's doing so to impress the elites in his society, this upper crust, stiff upper lip British society where his father belongs to. He's sent on sort of what's supposed to be a wild goose chase to find the Sasquatch in the Pacific Northwest. We're probably pretty close to where Laika Studios currently resides, to find a Sasquatch. And there he finds, well-spoken and slightly neurotic Sasquatch voiced by Zach Galifianakis, who he decides to name Mr. Link, and who names himself Susan. The two of them go on an adventure to find a colony of Yeti in the Alps.
Shangri-La.
Shangri-La, yeah. They're on a mission to find the land of Shangri-La, which may or may not exist, so that Mr. Link can be around people like himself. And I think that's a common theme we've seen run through a lot of Laika's material, is they do a lot of movies about the underdogs of society and sort of the people who don't fit in and the people who, you know, their imaginations kind of separate them from everybody else. And we see a lot of these stories about people sort of trying to connect to who feel othered, trying to connect to somebody who will understand them. And I think that this fits really well into that. What did you think of Missing Link?
So I don't know. I expected this movie to be a bit more of a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's terribly funny. And once I sort of came to that realization that it's not really a comedy, I started to enjoy it a little bit more.
Yeah.
I will say this movie is really charming.
Uh-huh.
And it's really sweet. But I don't know that it really gets much further beyond charming and sweet. I think the animation is gorgeous.
Absolutely
stunning animation. There are good chunks of it that I like, but as a whole, it just kind of felt a little, I don't know, like a little, like it was missing. It felt like, when you're eating like a pasta dish,
okay,
and it's just missing that little bit of spice or that little bit of flavor, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Like it just,
so it was a little bland.
Yeah. And I don't know entirely why, but I think I liked the characters. I think it has some fun adventure set pieces. This sort of felt like what the movie Tintin should have been.
Right.
It definitely, you know, there's these fun moments of adventure. I don't know. I couldn't quite connect with it, though. And I think it might be a little dull for kids, even.
I
don't know.
It's fairly short. It's 90 minutes or so. I will say it's a little... It isn't trying to pack the frame with as much action every shot. I will say that. And there's even some Leica films that are maybe visually a little more active than this film is. This one does have a sort of more laid-back quality to it. I think intentionally so. And I will agree that the humor in it is a little bit more dry and not necessarily, you know, running up to the next punchline every single second, especially given Zach Galifianakis doing the main character. He's not doing a Zach Galifianakis character.
No, I want to be clear that I don't think that's necessarily a negative thing. Like,
right.
Not all children's, you know, not all family movies need to be chock full of jokes for kids and adults. Like,
right.
It doesn't have to have that. It just felt a little flat. And I think that maybe if it isn't going to rely as much on humor, I don't know.
No, I think I do know, and I think the issue is the movie doesn't really have enough in the way of conflict. We have one villain in the whole picture, voiced by Timothy Oliphant, who's like this poacher who's sort of chasing them around and trying to get to the next set piece before they do. And every time they have an interaction with this character, it sort of resolves the same way every single time, where they just outrun him or they hide behind something and get away. And, you know, and we just kind of have that same interaction about five times in the movie. And that's the movie pretty much is just a collection of those interactions until we get to the final, shebang at Shangri-La. And I think it's, you know, it's fun getting from set piece to set piece. And there's a sort of Jewel of the Nile quality to the movie. You know, this kind of old-fashioned adventure film.
And I liked that aspect of it
a lot. And so the globetrotting and all of that stuff. And I think that's kind of the tone, the mood that it's more fitting into. It's humorous, it's comedic, but that it's also kind of soaking in the kind of travelogue quality of it as well. But yeah, for me, the thing that's missing from the movie to make it punch a little bit more is an antagonist that has kind of more of a clear function in the plot than the one that we have does.
And along with that, there isn't really much of an emotional conflict either. Like, I sort of thought that Lionel Frost would be a little bit worse of a character. Like, I thought, you know, he seems pretty genuine and he seems pretty noble from the beginning. And so I think maybe they could have gotten a little more juice out of that relationship between, you know, a monster hunter and a monster, where, you know, there, I think maybe there could have been a bit more of an emotional conflict as well, because that really isn't there. Like, you know, he says he'll help him and then he helps him and then he's not particularly nice to him for a while and then he sort of is.
Right. Well, I think,
and I think that maybe if there had been, if they had let Lionel Frost be a little bit more underhanded and a little bit shadier at the beginning, that character arc might have paid off a little better.
I think that the parallel that Chris Butler is trying to draw between, you know, Lionel and Mr. Link is their sort of statuses as outsiders in their societies. And and I think that the emotional conflict that is supposed to come about is both of them sort of coming to that conclusion that they don't need to be accepted in their societies, that they should be making a family of their own, sort of a discovered family.
Yeah.
If this has much to do with anything. I suspect maybe it does. I know that Chris Butler is gay, and that came up a little bit in Paranorman. And I think that those themes, while coded and covert, are weaved into this as well.
I'm not saying that I get that. I just think that they could have had, you know, like, that we could have seen maybe Lionel Frost struggle with that a little bit more. That duality of, like, do I really want to sell this guy out to belong to this group or whatever? Because he doesn't really. He just sort of goes on his adventure. And then at the end is, you know, is like, oh, I'm glad I went on this adventure. You know,
I think it might have been a little bit stronger if we had seen a little bit more from Lionel and his father's, like, past or something, or, like, set that up to why he wants to be in this in-group more than what the movie gives us. No, I don't want the movie to, like, be bogged down in backstory, and I think well enough that we don't want to weigh it down. But I think just something there to reinforce that, even if it was just one small scene or something in dialogue.
Well, so I think the way we're introduced to the main character is great. The way he sort of uses and abuses his assistant. First sidekick.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been nice to see him do that, have that sort of repeated behavior with Link or with Susan. Because Susan hasn't met anyone before him.
Right.
So we don't know how much, you know, he might be willing to tolerate. And so I think that maybe we could have played that out is a little bit more, and there might have been some more meat there. But, I mean, all in all, it's, you know, it's a perfectly charming film. I just think it could have connected emotionally a little bit more. I liked a lot of aspects of it. It never quite fully came together for me.
Okay. What are you giving it?
I'll give it a B-.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and give it a solid B. I liked it a decent amount. I'd see where it could definitely be a little stronger. And overall, I think the movie does feel small. And it maybe isn't as game changing as some of the other Laika films, even on a visual level, but I did like it a lot. It reminded me a little bit more in tone and spirit, like the Aardman films, like the, Shaun the Sheep and Wallace and Gromit, yeah, and like kind of those kinda movies. I wonder, maybe it'll travel more because of that. Like, maybe in England or Europe, the movie will find more of an audience.
I don't think that this movie, it's not bad by any means. Mm. I would certainly, like, if I had a kid, I would, you know, much rather have them watch this than other movies that are out there.
Right.
For sure. I think it is a good family film that does have kind of a connection to older style of movies that right. I did enjoy. I enjoyed all the movie making aspects of it. Mm-hmm. It was just sort of the script that I think felt a little, just a little light. I think it could have used a little more emotional padding.
Okay. All right. Well, that is the show. If anybody has anything they want to say to us, you can contact us at our email at MacGuffinPod@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/MacGuffinPod. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at MacGuffinPod. You can follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. You can read my writing that I've done weekly for the Idaho State Journal at their website, idahostatejournal.com. And you can also read some of the writing I provided for the Seattle-based entertainment website, for which this podcast is a component of, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. While you're there, you should be able to check out the other writing and articles by the rest of the staff of the MacGuffin. You can follow the podcast and stream us. If you happen to be, you know, listening to this via the website or something like that, we are available and subscribable on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, and maybe Pocket Cast? Yeah.
You can follow me on social media at Keith Foster Kid. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You can also check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com, for upcoming show dates. Come to these shows.
Go to Keith's shows if you're in the San Diego area.
Yeah.
Be sure to check out our friends who are also doing podcasts of their own, including Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places, and Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast. And I believe that is it.
Are we at the end?
We're at the end.
I am inevitable.